Welcome to Appaloosa Radio, where stories come alive. Appaloosa Radio is a service of the Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater. Regarding a 1947 murder. Myretta June Jones. By Stan Morgan, Private Investigator. Read by Linda and Winston G. and Dr. Greg Hummel. In honor of Stan Morgan. Chapter 1.
Chibaba, chibaba, chihuahua, and chilawa, kukala goomba. Chibaba, chibaba, chihuahua, my bambino go to sleep. Chibaba, chibaba, chihuahua. Chibaba, chibaba, chihuahua, and chilawa, kukala goomba. Chibaba, chibaba, chihuahua, my bambino go to sleep. Chibaba, chibaba, chihuahua, chibaba, chibaba, chihuahua, my bambino go to sleep. Chibaba, chibaba, chihuahua.
Have you ever been so frightened that you just don't want to get out of bed? So certain that something was going to harm you that you couldn't do anything? Dread so great that you couldn't even eat chocolate ice cream? I was a Marine, then a California peace officer, and finally, now, a private detective. However, I have only felt such fear once in my life, the night after we learned of the Pirate Cave murder.
It was what they said on the radio that scared me most. I have never heard the words deranged child killer, monstrosity of pure evil, or a demon-possessed slayer of God's innocence. That's what the radio said. They stopped all regular programming to tell the same story over and over. Little girl murdered. They gave her name. They gave her address. They interviewed witnesses within minutes of the police. Then they would rebroadcast those same interviews. It was an incessant, all-encompassing story. Sweet, innocent child murdered in children's pretend cave. I was frightened. My parents heard the warnings on the radio and then repeated them to me and to my little brother. Be careful, beware, be cautious. It's dangerous. There's a child killer out loose in our city. A child killer beating innocent children with a hammer. Be aware, be cautious, be careful. It is dangerous. A dear, sweet child brutally murdered. 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 Murdered.
Murdered. Murdered. Murdered. It was November 18th, 1947. I had just turned 8 and was in the 3rd grade at Wayside Elementary School in the southern edge of Bakersfield. Every day, my younger brother and I walked 3/4 of a mile from our house in the Southgate area to the school. To avoid walking along the busy Casa Loma Highway, we crossed the irrigation canal on a narrow cement bridge, 100 yards south of the highway. It was near there that the grisly event occurred.
A kindergarten child, a 5-year-old girl, was murdered the night before, battered innumerable times, the radio said, with a hammer. Every time the radio retold the story, a new set of shivers would go up and down my spine. I was afraid, pee in your pants afraid. To make matters even more fearful, she was murdered in the Pirate's Cave just steps from the concrete bridge across the irrigation canal. My brother and I had often played in the cave, defending it against the rough boys who lived in Billy Goat Acres, the so-called Oaky neighborhood just east of the irrigation canal.
My parents sometimes called the neighborhood of small frame houses that clustered along the Casa Loma Highway the Okies place. Billy Goat Acres was considered its nicer, more polite name. In 1947, many of the streets in Billy Goat Acres were not paved. Some of the houses were well built and included all the modern amenities, but certainly not all. Intermixed among the well-built houses were those that were quickly built of inferior materials, remnants of what had once been a temporary camp. The Okies had come to the valley during the Depression, initially taking farm jobs, picking cotton, or caring for the grapevines, or tending the valley's endless citrus orchards. The so-called Dust Bowl migrants came from Arkansas, Texas, Kansas, Nebraska, and, of course, Oklahoma. Many had been tenant farmers who had been evicted from their farms for not paying their rent. They hadn't paid their tenant rent because their crops had failed and agricultural prices had fallen. Their lives were featured in novels like John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath and represented in the hauntingly beautiful photographs of Dorothea Lange. They had been recruited to the valley by professional labor contractors with promises of high wages and unlimited opportunities. They were needed because President Calvin Coolidge had signed legislation banning immigration from Mexico. They arrived to find squalor, brutally hard work, stigmatization, and overt hostility.
Okie parents and their children were forced to pick cotton for many long hours in the valley's heat, just to earn enough for the family to eat. Okie children often went to school, if they went at all, with no shoes and hand-me-down clothes. Very few Okie families had access to doctors or electricity or indoor plumbing. Many families lived in tar paper shanties and farm camps for which they were forced to pay exorbitant rent. They talked Okie and thus experienced the continuing prejudice of being low-class, dumb hicks, who were perpetually up to no good. Okies were not welcomed in the Central Valley. Many cities posted their signs saying so. By the late 1940s, things had improved for the Dust Bowl immigrants. Some remained migrant agriculture workers, following the seasonal harvest cycle of crops. Some, like those families in Billy Goat Acres, stayed in Bakersfield, working whatever odd jobs they could. Now, in the late 1940s, Kern County's oil industry was booming, and some Okies had taken jobs as roughnecks in the oil industry. The work was hard, dirty, and wholly unpredictable. Yet despite economic hardship and social stigmatization, most Okie families thrived. They did so by their strong, continuing connection to their extended families. They faced obstacles as well-connected families, not merely as individuals. There was no one more important in these extended families than Granny, the female matriarch on whom the whole family depended. Granny's word was law, and everyone knew it. No one ever challenged it.
My own family, on the other hand, lived in the better neighborhood, further to the south, across Chester Avenue. It was called Southgate. In Southgate, parents had regular jobs, went to church, and owned their homes in a newly built housing tract. Our streets were paved and there were sidewalks. Southgate had its own supermarkets, pharmacies, and clothing stores. Our houses had washing machines, electric stoves, and patches of green lawn. As I reflect on the social reality of Bakersfield in the 1940s, I realize that there really weren't that many differences between my own Southgate neighborhood and Billy Goat Acres. Both were primarily working-class neighborhoods, beginning a normalized life after the war. Nonetheless, we believe the other neighborhood was inferior to ours. They were always the enemy, the rough boys from over there. There was one point of overlap between the boys in my neighborhood and the rough boys from Billy Goat Acres. It was the 25-foot high dirt mound left over from when they first dug the irrigation canal. We called it the mountain. Someone, we didn't know who, had dug a cave into the mountain. I am now convinced that the cave had once been a transient's home. But to us, it became the pirate cave, a place we could crawl into and dig for buried treasure. Of course, we always had to defend our cave from the Billy Goat Acres boys, who also viewed the pirate cave as theirs. The wars were endless. Our weapons were loud words, clods of dirt, and occasionally our fists.
The radio repeated that the victim, a kindergarten girl, went to my school and had been murdered in our pirate cave, which made the events feel all the more dangerous. It was not a murder across town, or up in Taft, or over in Delano. It was here. Near the narrow cement bridge, we used every day on our way to school. Now, I couldn't pass the dreaded mountain without cringing in fear. At dinner that night, I took 2 bites of my food. But then rushed from the table directly to the bathroom to throw everything up. My mother was an empathetic Southern woman, originally from Mount Airy, North Carolina, and she became concerned about how the events were affecting me. She decided to turn the radio off, to stop the incessant reporting on the investigation. She also refused to let me see the newspapers where coverage was just as lurid and detailed. Even in the third grade, I was a voracious reader of the newspaper, often cutting out stories that I liked and pasting them into a scrapbook that I had begun. Without the constant flood of sensationalistic news coverage, I gradually regained my composure, and my intense fears subsided. A week or so after the first news stories broke, we were sitting at our dinner table when my father calmly announced that they had found the little girl's murderer. It was an older girl with some mental issues. He said no more. No one in my family ever spoke of the events again.
Even though the radio news was no longer allowed in my house, the murder remained a major news event for Bakersfield. It remained so until the older girl's trial had concluded, until justice had been meted out. One day on my way to school, I noticed that someone had brought in a bulldozer and completely removed the pirate cage.
I forgot about the story until many years later. As a private investigator, I decided to reopen the case and to conduct my own investigation. For reasons that I will explain more later, I have chosen to assign a fictitious name to the crime's perpetrator. I will call her Wanda Evans. However, I will honor the victim by retaining her real name, Maretta June Jones. I began my investigation in the archives of the Bakersfield newspaper. I knew the date. It is one that I have never forgotten. I also knew that there had been extensive news coverage of the case. However, I was unprepared for the sheer volume of news coverage. I filled a very large file folder with clippings. I could easily fill 2 more. I was immediately struck by how different news coverage was in 1947 versus today. The newspaper carried many large photographs of the murder scene, the victim's blood-stained clothes, the young accused girl and her family, and the various witnesses interviewed by the police. Reporters described every gruesome detail in the most purple prose. Words like horrific, demonic, savage, and vicious were in practically every sentence.
The newspapers even printed the entire psychological report prepared by the psychiatric team at Camarillo State Hospital, noting that Wanda had a mental age 2 years behind her actual age. She had also suffered early brain damage, and that the events may have been provoked by an increased sexual tension coinciding with her first menstrual period, just a few days earlier. We would never, never, see such reporting today, especially regarding a just-turned 14-year-old.
If I had been the attorney defending the young Wanda for this crime, I would have immediately requested a change of venue. There is no way to describe the Bakersfield press coverage other than rabid. After I obtained my folder of press stories from the newspaper's archives, I then visited the Kern County Courts and requested a transcript of the trial and photographs of the evidence submitted. The trial itself was quite brief. The most significant issue was whether Miss Wanda Evans would be tried as an adult or as a juvenile.
Wanda Evans became one of the youngest women ever convicted in a California court for first-degree murder. She was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole.
My father had been a career Navy petty officer. In early 1947, his ship, the U.S. Kaufman's aircraft carrier, landed in San Francisco, and he was discharged. He took the train down to Bakersfield, where his family had lived since the 1860s. He joined my uncle in the family's pump maintenance business and bought a home close to the newly constructed Wayside Elementary School. My father was a dedicated member of the Kern County Sheriff's Auxiliary. He spent most weekends assisting the sheriff's office in its many duties, often riding with officers on patrol. Because Billy Goat Acres was outside the city limits of Bakersfield, it fell to the sheriff's office to patrol the neighborhood. My father joined officers in many Saturday night patrols in the Billy Goat Acres area. He told me that Saturday nights were often very raucous there. He said he saw lots of drinking and a fair number of fights. As an auxiliary, my father could not arrest anybody. However, if my father and the deputy he was riding with received a call about fractious events in Billy Goat Acres, it was up to the two of them to settle things down. It would usually be a thing between the young bucks from different extended families. My father once told me in a moment of candor that those Okey bucks know how to do three things: drink, fight, and sing. Over time, the Kern County officers had learned that the best way to handle a Saturday night ruckus was to get the various grannies involved. A grandma could cool things down quickly by telling her boys to go home and sleep it off. Grandma's word was always law. Both girls, the victim Myretta June Jones and the perpetrator Wanda Evans, lived in Billy Goat Acres. They both came from Okey families. However, their situations were very different. Myretta June was being cared for by her maternal grandmother while her own mother worked. She had other extended relatives who lived close by. The extended Jones family had lived in Bakersfield for several years.
Wanda's family, on the other hand, was different. They had recently moved to Bakersfield, but had no extended family ties in the community. Wanda's own mother was said to have abandoned Wanda after her divorce. Wanda was then just 9. Wanda's father, Calvin, had remarried to a woman named Edith. I could find nothing about Edith's background when I reviewed the news articles. Nor do we know where Edith was during the day of the murder. We do know she was not home. Wanda was tasked with preparing dinner and doing housework. From the news articles, we know that Myretta June's family had a telephone. Wanda's family did not. I sense a clear status difference between Myretta June's family and Wanda's. The Jones's family was considerably more settled and more connected than Wanda's. The differences in family status were clear. The Billy Goat Acres neighborhood was very close-knit. It is notable how many different witnesses saw the two girls together on the afternoon of Myretta June's murder. Altogether, the investigation found about 20 witnesses, including Wanda's older brother, Harry. Although the radio and newspaper reporters kept raising the specter of unknown male culprit within the very first hour from witness interviews, the investigators knew there was no such perpetrator. Many children from Billy Goat Acres were, of necessity, left to fend for themselves. Family incomes were small and often erratic. Many of the community's families had to work an assortment of different odd jobs to make ends meet. This meant that children were often left without supervision. The so-named mountain became a favorite place for kids to play and to gather. Its cave was a special place to hide from older children and from adult authorities. The evidence I have seen convinces me that Wanda had often been to the Pirate's Cave and that she understood that it was a place where adults never came.
It was just six houses, less than 1 minute from Wanda's. There was no fence blocking off the irrigation canal, so it was easy to get to.
However, I'm not sure whether Moretta June had ever been there before. Unlike many other neighborhood children, Moretta June was under the strict supervision of her granny, who might well stop any potential excursion to such a wild place.
At about 3:30 in the afternoon, Moretta June was sent to the nearby wayside grocery with 20 cents to buy a can of tomato juice. She never came back. At the store, she met Wanda Evans. Wanda and Moretta June left the store together and went to Wanda's house, where Wanda peeled potatoes, swept the house, and did some other chores. At Wanda's suggestion, the two girls went to the Pirate Cave.
Wanda was seen next to the irrigation canal washing off her blouse. Wanda went home, ate her dinner, but went to bed early without listening to the radio. Her parents reported that she always loved to listen to the radio, so by going to bed early, she was behaving in an unusual way. Otherwise, she seemed calm without apparent distress. A little after 4 in the afternoon, Moretta June's grandmother calls her daughter, saying that she is concerned that Moretta June had not yet returned from the store.
Within an hour, an extensive search was begun. Some say it was Wanda's older brother Harry, suggested they search the Pirate Cave.
They found Moretta June's body badly battered and very bloody body. Those, to my mind, are the undisputed facts. To learn more, you'll need a witness, and there's only one, 13-year-old Wanda Evans.
Police investigators broke the tiny 13-year-old during their third round of intense questioning. They reported that she had made a full and complete confession. At her trial, she pled guilty and was sentenced to life in prison. I am a trained criminal investigator who has conducted many interrogations. I know the tricks, techniques, ruses, and roles that investigators employ to obtain a written confession. Some members of the public believe that during a confession, an individual voluntarily tells a coherent and complete story, including all the pertinent details. They do it, folks believe, because they have a guilty conscience and need to bare their soul. However, from my experience, that is almost never the case. Every investigator I have ever known goes into each interrogation with a theory about what happened. It is that prior theory that guides the interrogation. In the interview room, they query, probe, pressure, confront, cajole, baby, accuse, mistake, scream, beg, starve, terrorize, lie, and sometimes even tell the truth in order to gain as many specific details as they can. Details are an investigator's best friend. Big, general lies are easy to disprove. What is logarithmically harder is a coherent and believable story with details. More details increase credibility. Ever more specific details enhance credibility even more. In any interview, the investigator is seeking details, which taken together either confirm or discount the theory that the investigator already has. As an experienced crime investigator, I can tell from the pattern of questions what the investigator's theory about the crime is. As I read and reread Wanda Evans' confession, I can clearly see the theory in which the 1947 investigators believed. Unfortunately, as I now look at that theory, I can see that in most respects it was completely wrong.
The Bakersfield investigators had two theories to explain the murder of the kindergarten girl. One was that Wanda Evans suffered from extreme mental illness. Wanda's father is quoted in the newspapers claiming that she was paranoid, always acting strange, he said. In response to this theory, the court ordered Wanda Evans to undergo extensive psychological evaluation at the nearby state mental hospital. Wanda spent 3 months undergoing psychiatric evaluation. It was discovered that Wanda had endured serious brain trauma as an infant. Still, she was eventually found to be dull-witted but sane. The second theory was the one that was invoked in her harsh sentencing. Wanda Evans was deemed a lesbian predator who had sought to seduce the tiny kindergartner. The key to this theory was that Wanda had ordered Myretta June to take off all her clothes. The 5-year-old was found beaten and naked. Again and again, the original investigators returned to this theory, pressuring Wanda about playing with herself and asking whether she enjoyed watching naked children. It is this theory that I now see as without basis, a complete falsehood. Let me be clear. I now believe that 13-year-old Wanda Evans invited Myretta June to the Pirate Cave, and that Wanda knew it was a place beyond an adult purview or control. I believe that the young kindergartner became frightened and began screaming, very loudly, for her grandmother. I believe Wanda panicked, picked up a rock, and hit Myretta June multiple times. She did so, I now believe, because Myretta June was screaming. I now believe, as her defense attorney did, that Wanda Evans was in a complete panic. She wholly lacked the decision-making skills to consider either consequences or other alternative courses of action. She was by all accounts a young woman suffering from a developmental delay. However, I do not believe that Wanda Evans was a lesbian sexual pervert. She was not attempting to recruit the younger girl into a deviant lifestyle. In the long and intense interviews, the investigators kept returning to a theme, Wanda's purported enjoyment from playing with herself. The investigators clearly believed that Wanda had targeted Myretta June as a potential sex partner. Wanda, they said again and again. We know that you play with yourself. We have medical evidence, from the doctor that you do. We also have medical evidence that you played with Myretta June. Wanda admitted to brutally murdering Myretta June, but she never admitted to female masturbation. I never did that. That was bad. I didn't do that. Finally, the investigators broke Wanda. She admitted that she may have touched Myretta June down there. I now believe that the original investigators got it wrong. Really wrong. I think the evidence shows that Wanda also had been the victim of sexual violence. Someone had demanded that she take off all her clothes and then perform sexual activities. I have taken university courses on identifying and treating victims of child sex abuse. Wanda, to my mind, is a classic victim of this type of crime. I do not believe that the abuse was a one-time event. I believe it happened many times. Each time that it happened, she felt afraid, vulnerable, powerless. There was nothing she could do. She was humiliated, terrified, and forced to be submissive. Terrible things happened to her, yet, she could not stop it. She was small and weak. In every way a victim. My theory of the crime is very different from the original investigators. I would not be looking for an aggressive lesbian nymphomaniac seeking to lure young girls into her immoral web. No, for me, this was not a sex crime. Rather, I think it was about power that Wanda Evans never had. When Wanda was abused, humiliated, forced to submit, she felt small and powerless. In the pirate cave, the small Wanda suddenly felt large compared to the very small five-year-old. In the cave, a place where adults never ventured, a place where no one could see in, Wanda held absolute power. Everyone, particularly the small Myretta June, had to do what Wanda said. Wanda was in power. Now, she would show someone else what it felt like to be humiliated, powerless, afraid, unable to resist, compelled to follow orders. Wanda was in power. Take off your clothes. Do what I tell you. I am in charge. At first, Myretta June objected, but powerful Wanda pulled her hair and hit her hard with her fists. You will comply with my orders. I am the powerful Wanda. I can do anything I want. There was one significant difference between Wanda and Myretta June. When Wanda had been abused, humiliated, defiled, no one had intervened. She had no protector. She was a victim who could be harmed without consequences. Myretta June, on the other hand, had a grandmother who protected her. Even as Wanda beat her, Myretta June was loudly threatening to tell her grandma. And this was not just any grandmother, this was a powerful Oki grandmother with the fury of an Oklahoma tornado.
Wow.